A warm greeting to our dear listeners wherever you may be listening from. This is Iran Radio from the heart of Iran's vibrant capital, Tehran. Straightly, we go to the interesting facts about Islam. During the Golden Age of Islam, Muslims created a house of wisdom, or Baitul Hikmah, which was active during the 9th and 13th century, where both Muslims and non-Muslim scholars sought to translate the world's knowledge into Arabic. Many classic works of antiquity that might have otherwise been lost were preserved in Arabic and Persian and later translated into Turkish, Hebrew, and Latin. Here, scholars synthesized and significantly advanced knowledge gained from the Persian, Roman, Chinese, Egyptian, Greek, Byzantine, and Phoenician civilizations. Muslim scholars like Ibn Rushd and Avicenna were primarily responsible for saving the works of prominent Greek philosopher Aristotle. For this hour, we have Spotlight. Then we have Bridge, connecting you to sacred supplications. This program presents a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications from the noble book of Sahifa As-Sajjadiyah. Sahifa As-Sajjadiyah is a collection of 54 supplications and prayers dedicated by Imam Sajjad, Shia's fourth Imam, peace be upon him. Then we have another segment of radio productions. Up next is a Spotlight. Stay tuned.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Reactions are pouring in after Israeli forces carried out a deadly incursion into a Damascus suburb, killing at least 13 people, including children. Syria's foreign ministry condemned the attack as a brutal massacre, saying Israeli forces resorted to indiscriminate shelling after failing to advance on the ground. The ministry held Israel fully responsible, warning that its continued attacks threaten regional stability. Palestinian resistance groups also condemned the strike, saying the incursion shows Israel poses a threat to the wider region. Qatar also denounced the attack as a blatant violation of Syrian sovereignty and international law. On Friday, Israeli forces raided the Syrian town of Beit Jinn before launching artillery and missile strikes, leaving multiple people dead. We'll be discussing the Israeli violations and much more on tonight's edition of Spotlight with our guests. Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nimr, who's with us from Ramallah. And we also have security and political analyst, Mr. Ali Risk, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Nimr. Can you break down for us, please, what is happening in Syria as the Israelis are repeatedly and casually encroaching on another Arab country's territorial integrity?
Well, I believe that this is exactly what we have to understand, that Israel is going to do this again and again in all of the region, not only in Syria, but in Lebanon, and they are doing that also in Gaza in spite of the ceasefire. It's the idea that Israel wanted to put forward their own ideas about how they are going to treat or to deal with the area from the upper hand of the Israelis, and that they can do whatever they want at any time they want. What happened today, when they went to arrest some people from the suburb of Damascus, they faced the people themselves. It's not the army, it's not the regime in Syria, it was the people of the village, because they can't accept the idea of, you know, the occupation and what the occupation is doing, since they are occupying this part of Syria. And they resist the Israeli force and causing them heavy casualties of three in critical conditions and three were injured. And that was surprising for the Israelis. That's what matters. Now in Israel, they are discussing this issue, whether there was lack of information, whether that was a mistake, a tactical mistake. But they are really annoyed with that. And that's why they sent back the Air Force and the artillery to shell this village, causing more than 13 of murders in this village. The idea here that Israel wanted to say, to set a kind of a format for the region, that we can do whatever we want. And if we return back to what Netanyahu said about the peace, which now Lebanon is talking about, negotiations with Israel, and also in Syria, they are talking about negotiation with Israel. Netanyahu said, only with Israeli strong army we can impose the peace that we want. This kind of peace that he wanted, the peace that you have to comply directly to what the Israeli wanted. Otherwise, they will continue to bombard here and there and to have atrocities against these countries and these regions unless you comply exactly with what the Israeli wanted. This is this kind of peace that they are thinking of. So I think that's for the whole region and for all the Arab and Islamic countries to understand that you can't deal with this kind of entity. This regime, a fascist regime, it's not going to make peace in the region. To the contrary, they wanted to control the whole area, and this is their aim, and it's quite obvious in all these incidents that is happening, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon or even in Syria now.
Okay, let's bring in Mr. Rizk from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Ali Rizk, weigh in on the events for us, please. And also another matter that has become even more clear than before is that Israel can attack where and when it wants. Clear actions of an international pariah and rogue regime. However, there's no accountability for these actions. How worrying and dangerous is this level of impunity for the region?
Well, that's nothing new. Ever since October 7, the Israelis have begun to behave as if they have the right to do as they wish, as if they're above international law, under this pretext of what happened, again, on October 7. So this is kind of a new Israeli strategy, and they have full American backing up until now regarding that strategy. But I'm not sure how wise the Israelis are being when it comes to Syria, because you have the new Syrian figures in power led by Ahmad al-Sharaa. They've been extending a hand to Israel for quite some time. And that's being met only with more Israeli aggressions, more Israeli occupation, more Israeli escalation. So in my humble opinion, the Israelis are actually committing a fatal mistake. They have there's a neighboring country there which is offering to be their ally. And they're actually, if they continue to do this, they're transforming that potential ally into an enemy. So I don't believe that speaks very well to the Israeli strategic thinking. And I think it just goes to show that the Israelis are pursuing hegemony at all costs. And I think if you can even more accurately describe it as being irrational hegemonic policy, which won't be good for the Israelis in the long term. And this has contributed to the emergence of a resistance. It appears that a resistance against Israel is in the works in Syria. Incidentally, this incident took place after Netanyahu and some senior Israeli figures visited. They took actually a tour in Syrian territory. So I think it's important to link it to that there are many in Syria, notwithstanding the gestures which are being made by al-Sharaa and by his government, there are many in Syria who are on a completely different page and refuse to allow Israel to do as it wishes and to behave in this way in Syria. So again, I don't think that the general Israeli approach towards Syria is a very wise approach, and what happened in Beijing, I believe, is evidence of that.
Sure. Professor Nimr, on that issue, we've seen the reactions from the HTS-led government. Many have criticized it, actually, for being insufficient. There are Syrian human rights activists criticizing the HTS-led government in Damascus for its failure to stop the Israeli regime's crimes since day one. Why this silence and lackluster reactions to the Israelis' attacks and crimes that they've been carrying out against Syria since day one?
The first thing that the Syrians are not intending anyway to have a kind of a conflict with the Israeli. From day one, they were talking about, you know, that they are willing to have peace with Israel and they are willing to be part of, you know, whatever is prepared for the region by the Americans. And they showed a kind of, you know, a full cooperation with Israel. But the Israeli are not doing that because they have their own conditions which Syria can't accept. This is one issue. The other issue, Syria unable to face Israel at this moment for many reasons. First of all, it's very new regime, around 1 year now. And at the same time, remember that after the collapse of the previous regime, immediately Israel destroyed around 85% of the capability of the Syrian army, whether it's in the tanks and airplanes and the artillery and all things. So now I don't think that Syria in a position to stand against Israel as we talk in a kind of a war or in a kind of, you know, an aggression against aggression. But they can do something else, I mean, you know, to clear that they are going out of any kind of cooperation, and they can allow, and they will say that if you are occupying our country, so definitely there will be resistance. So try to at least do these kind of things in order to pressurize the Israeli, because on the other hand, they can't do anything else, nothing else. It's only the diplomatic kind of way in order to stop Israel. And that's why we have the foreign ministry statement today, which is condemning and holding Israel responsibility. So what? So what? This is not definitely not enough. And they should do something, especially with the Americans, that now they are, you know, having this kind of relationship with the American. This will affect the American interest in the region. I think that they should now understand that they should apply some pressure on the Americans. It's not only the Syrians. I'm talking about all the Arabs. Why they are, you know, not even thinking about that. That's exactly also the same situation in Lebanon. In Lebanon, the President Aoun, he just delivered the speech and he said that we are willing to negotiate with the Israeli and to start the negotiations to ceasefire permanently and to take out the Israeli out of Lebanon, the withdrawal and disarmament of Hezbollah. The answer came 2 days later, immediately by the Israeli, by targeting Beirut and Hartahrek in Beirut. That was an assassinating, you know, Tabtabai. This is quite obvious that this is the answer of Israel. They are not willing to negotiate with any Arab country unless they are totally comply with what the Israeli wanted and they are under the order of Israel. That's the kind of negotiation that the Israeli understand now. And this is what Netanyahu talked about, is the new Middle East that he's looking for. These yes. countries supposed to submit to the Israeli will.
Ali Rizk, Syrians are also not happy with the violation of their sovereignty by the Israeli regime. Protests have been held across Syria following Friday prayers in condemnation of the latest Israeli crimes in the Damascus suburbs. Do you think that this will also lead to rising opposition across Syria to the HTS-led government for their attitude that they've shown towards the Israelis and for their lack of action as well?
I think it will, the more the Israelis continue with this escalation. I think that will put more pressure, more popular pressure, on the Ashara regime. I think that this, in the end, it'll put pressure in terms of Ashara's efforts to try and reach. As I said before, he's been making gesture after gesture towards Israel, and that's been met only with more Israeli escalation, which exposes Ashara to be rather humiliated. So I think that the pressure is going to pile up, and this may lead Ashara to somewhat take a different kind of course, not being so conciliatory towards the Israelis, particularly when Ashara, before his previous name, Al-Julani, meaning the Golan Heights, he had spoken about liberating the Golan Heights, etc. He's taking a completely opposite approach. So I think it is bound, if it continues, if the Israeli escalation continues leading to more popular pressure on Ashara, I think it's bound to lead to some kind of change. And again, this brings me back. Israel is isolating itself in the region. But you have to remember, I think, at the same time, what Israel's objectives are. One of the main motivators for Israel's escalation in Syria is to prevent the strengthening of Turkey. Now, we all know that Ashara is very close to Turkey, and what the Israelis are saying now is that having Ashara strong in Syria means having strong Turkish influence, and Turkey is seen as a competitor for Israel in terms of regional domination, being a major regional heavyweight. So a lot of Netanyahu's calculations stem from that perspective. So the Israelis are turning potential friends into potential enemies, but it's part of a broader project to establish undisputed Israeli hegemony, whereby they want to eliminate any Iranian competition, any Turkish competition, to be the undisputed hegemon. Now, I think the guest mentioned the issue of the United States. This is where I believe that there might be differences between the U.S. and Israel. When it comes to fighting Iran, I think that the Israelis and the Americans are on the same page. But when it comes to countering Turkey, I don't think that the Israelis and Americans are on the same page. Israel wants to establish hegemony, complete hegemony, including by diminishing any Turkish role, any Turkish influence. But the United States considers Turkey to be a partner in the region. The problem is that, as I've argued many times, is that the Americans are more in sync with the Israeli policy, or in other words, the Israelis often succeed in dragging the U.S. in the way they want in terms of regional policy. Will they succeed again in doing this now in Syria? I think only time will tell after this incident.
Very well. Professor Nimrod, the Israeli Prime Minister is attacking Syria out of desperation for a political and military victory after repeated failures. Do you agree with that notion?
To a certain degree, yes, because now remember that Israel is approaching also the elections, and some part of the actions by the Israelis, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon or in Syria now, it's also part of the campaign for the next elections. He wanted to say that we are still involved in security, and now Israel, I am, as Netanyahu, the king, as his followers would like to call him, is the one who could deliver the security for Israel and the domination over the area, and to put down any potential danger on Israel by Arab countries. So this is the what Netanyahu is thinking of now, and especially that they are approaching the elections by next year, or you know, like few months, if you like. Because of that, this is one of the things that in the mind of Netanyahu. But there are also lots of criticism inside Israel today, especially after they woke up in what was going on, and even the opposition in Israel are talking about this operation as a part of, you know, kind of Netanyahu wanted to show off some kind of operations here and there in order to have more of supporters during the elections. So this is, you know, one of the things which is Netanyahu is focusing on. And I do agree with Ali totally that Israel is doing really very harm to themselves on the long run by bringing in more and more enemies. And especially now we are talking about the people, and that what was really very, you know, important for the Israelis, that it's not the army, it's not the regime, it was the people of the village of Beit Jan who started this kind of resistance against the Israelis. So if that going to be repeated everywhere, so they are opening a new kind of a front for the Israelis, and the Israelis are now talking about, is that necessary in this moment to open a new front or not? So this is really put Israel in a very awkward situation.
Ali Risk, there is this theory since day one when, as you phrased it, these new figures in Syria came to power that the HTS has been tasked with the Balkanization of Syria. I want to get your thoughts on that viewpoint. And if that's the case, who benefits the most from this breakup of Syria?
I'm not sure about that theory that HTS has been cast with the mission or tasked, sorry, with the mission of dividing or fragmenting Syria. Remember, again, Ashara, his closest ally, arguably his closest ally, is Turkey. Turkey doesn't want the Balkanization of Syria. That would give the Kurds semi-independence. That's the last thing Turkey wants. So I would be a bit hesitant to buy into this argument that somehow HTS has come in order to Balkanize Syria. I do think that Israel wants that. That would serve Israel very well to have an Alawite, then a Sunni, then a Kurdish statelet, particularly when the Israelis are talking about having a Jewish state. Ultimately, what the Israelis want, in my humble opinion, in Syria, is for there to be a failed state. And they want the same thing in Lebanon, by the way. They want it in all surrounding countries. Because when you have a failed state, that's the perfect pretext to further expand territorially. Under the pretext that failed states pose a threat because of the chaos, so then we must expand our borders. That, I think, is the Israeli strategy. And again, this strategy collides with the strategies of other players who are American allies. Again, I refer to Turkey. So no, I don't think that somehow Ashara has been tasked by those who support him to Balkanize Syria, Turkey and others, but I do think that that is the Israeli goal.
Professor Nim, how has the silence of Arab and Islamic nations emboldened Israel to press ahead with its illegal actions in Syria? You addressed that a little earlier. I want you to elaborate on that for us as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Arab and Islamic countries, they do have the power not to pressurize Israel directly, but to pressurize the Americans. The Americans got their approval in whatever they are doing in the area, and they are, you know, very happy with that. And especially when Trump put forward his 20 points plan for Gaza to cease fire, that was approved by Arab and Islamic countries. They also affected even the United Nations resolution on the same way when Russia and China have another suggestion, but the Arab and Islamic countries, they said that we are agreeing to that, so why you are objecting? So it's obvious that they have the ability to pressurize the Americans. The Americans do know that they have interest in the region, and especially Arab countries of the Gulf states. The Americans knows that their interest there should not be contradicted with what Israel wanted if that come to the end of it. So I think they have the power to pressurize the Americans if they wanted to do so. The question is, are they willing to do so or not? I don't think that they are willing to do it, and they are not much interested on one hand. On the other hand, most of them are complying with what the Israeli wanted in this respect. So because of that, they are not, you know, playing any role to prevent Israel of doing what they are doing in the region. For God's sake, you know, they bombarded even Qatar, which is, you know, considered one of the biggest allies to the Americans and the biggest base for the Americans in the region. And still they got away with it. So the Arab and Islamic countries are not doing any role in order to prevent Israel of doing that, though they have the ability to do it, but they don't have the will to do it.
Ali Risco, final question to you. Many countries and groups have weighed in with their condemnations, but the likes of the U.S. and EU have not with regards to this recent attack on the village of Beit Jinn. How do you view the inconsistency from these Western capitals and also the silence of their mainstream media outlets regarding Israeli actions in Syria? I'm not even sure if we can call it inconsistency anymore, because in these matters, they seem to be consistently inconsistent.
Well, I'm quite sure that the West, Europe, and the United States are basically bought into this argument, which the Israelis are saying that this was an anti-terrorist operation. According to Israeli media, The operation was to arrest three members of Al-Jama'a Al-Islamiyya. And after that arrest took place, then they opened fire, that group. Al-Jama'a Al-Islamiyya is a Lebanese-based group, by the way. It's the Lebanese affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood. And what's interesting here is that just a few days ago, the Trump administration designated certain branches of the Muslim Brotherhood as terrorist organizations. If I'm not mistaken, Al-Jama'a Al-Islamiyya is one of them, which was designated as a terrorist organization. So the West is going to see this, I think, through the lens, or portray it through the lens of an anti-terrorist operation, more than being any kind of violation of sovereignty or any kind of aggression against another country, despite the fact, and this is important, despite the fact that the Americans have invested quite a lot in Ashara. I mean, Trump welcomed him to the White House. It wasn't the usual meeting. He was forced to go through a side door. But nevertheless, that was a big investment, especially when someone who used to be with Al-Qaeda, maybe he still is, I don't know, and Al-Qaeda was responsible for September 11. So the U.S. was willing to put all that aside and welcome Al-Shara. Of course, the main aim for them, for the Trump administration, is because Al-Shara up until now was anti-Iran, and anything anti-Iran for the Trump administration is considered to be a blessing or something positive. So that's the approach which the West takes, again, which is not necessarily consistent with American interests. I don't think it's in American interests to have Al-Shara weaken, which would weaken Turkey and influence badly the partnership between Turkey and the U.S. The U.S., if it wants to preserve interest in this region, it can't be only supporting Israel whilst being the enemy of all the rest of the Arab countries. It's true what your guest said, that Arab countries haven't spoken up, but I think in the end they will be forced to speak up. And the question remains, is America willing to sacrifice all of its interests for the sake of the most fascist Israeli government? That remains to be seen.
All right, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, Professor Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. Also, thanks to security and political analyst Ali Rizk, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And, of course, a special thanks to you all for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdu wa thana' lillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salam ala ashraf al-anbiya wal mursaleen. Habib gulubana wa tabib nufusana abil ghasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala al-bayt al-tayyibin al-tahirin. Respected brothers and sisters, it's an honor and a blessing for me to be spending the next few minutes on one of the greatest du'as and supplications of Sahifa al-Sajjadiyya, the great legacy of Imam Zain al-Abidin. We've started the 20th du'a, which is titled وَكَانَ مِن دُعَائِهِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ فِي مَكَارِمِ الْأَخْلَاقِ وَمَرْضِيِ الْأَفْعَالِ. On noble moral traits and acts pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The supplication of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam on that. And the very beginning portion of the dua, the very beginning phrase, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam presents Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with four requests. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Begins the dua by blessing Muhammad and his household. So we do the same. وَبَلِّغْ بِإِمَانِ أَكْمَلَ الْإِيمَانِ. Cause my faith to reach the most perfect faith. Something that we talked about in the previous session in detail. What I wanted to mention in this regard is that the righteous actions is mentioned after faith in many verses in the Holy Quran. Such as the very famous one that perhaps many of you or all of you recited on a daily basis in your salat. أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والعصر إن الإنسان لفي خسر إلا الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات. Right? By the time or by the element of the time, verily man is in loss, right? Except those who believe, right? Faith comes first and perform righteous deeds. That's why Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in the very, very first line of this dua says, وَبَلِّغْ بِإِيمَانِ أَكْمَلَ الْإِيمَانِ. Make my iman and faith to become the most complete. And then by that, and if that becomes the case, the next level is the excellency in certainty. وَجْعَلْ يَقِينِ أَفْضَلَ الْيَقِينِ. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back shortly. رَبَّنَا
Salvation, a way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana,
respected brothers and sisters, the many similar verses, all of which indicate that the righteous action were part of faith, a subsequent or a subcategory or a result and fruit and product of faith, right? It would not be necessarily to mention it. And it's certain that the lack of or the lack or deficiency of action is evidence of the lack of weakness or the lack of existence of faith, right? If someone's actions are not matching with what they claim to be believing in, then you should doubt their claim, right? For example, if I say I believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and I believe that He's just and He sees everything we do, good or bad, then I do continue to oppress my beloved family, my surrounding people in any way that I have the ability to do so, it means that I do not really have faith in a God that sees everything, good or bad, right? That means that belief is just a claim. It's not belief. It's not settled and synced into our hearts. The second part of this portion, this phrase, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam asks Allah the Almighty the request, which presents him with the request for completing or reaching the most excellent and the best stage of yaqeen, certainty, right? This request, in fact, is the plea for the best stage of, for the highest level of yaqeen. Some people have assumed that certainty is a definitive belief in which the possibility of believing its opposite is entirely non-existent. For example, I see the sun in the sky and I'm walking and there's daylight. I see it by my own eyes. No matter how many times, how many people would insist, hey, we are spending time in the middle of the night, I won't take their words. Why? Because I'm seeing the sun by my own eyes and I believe that I'm breathing in a daytime, right? I'm in a daytime and whatever other people say will have no zero effect on me. But imagine if the case was the other way. Therefore, it seemingly makes no sense to consider certainty as having different stages or different beliefs or different ideas. No, once you reach the level of certainty, then things become completely clear for you, completely clear, to the extent that the opposite idea or the opposite so-called belief is considered non-existent. Let's take another break. Inshallah, we'll be back shortly.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
Our respected brothers and sisters, we've been saying that certainty is the fruit, is the next level, or is the advanced stage of having complete faith. When you have complete faith, then you will reach a new realm called the realm of certainty, the realm of the most complete faith. And Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, do not only make me enter that realm, but also elevate me to have the most excellent, the best, afdal al-yaqeen, the highest level of certainty. The truth is that ilm al-yaqeen, the knowledge of certainty, is only one stage of certainty. Higher than that is ayn al-yaqeen, right? The most tangible level of certainty. It's there for you. The first one, ilm al-yaqeen, you have the knowledge of certainty. You know it's there, right? You know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is there. Ayn al-yaqeen is that you consider Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by the full capacity of your heart that He's there. You do not have the knowledge. You feel it. It's most tangible, right? And the highest, is there a higher level than that? Yes, the highest level of conviction and certainty is haqq al-yaqeen, the truth of certainty. You completely fade in the fact that, for example, Allah is there. You never forget it. It's always there for you, which is considered, again, the highest level and highest rank of conviction. Inshallah, in the next session, I'll make an example of differentiating between the three. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهن عشق و تولای تو را
Oh, mountains of Mecca. praising Allah, to glorify Allah. O mountains of Mecca, what can you tell of the day that stones from the sky fell, destroying an army determined to break the house of Allah that Abraham built? O mountains of Mecca, how was the dawn on the day that my prophet Muhammad was born? How did it feel knowing he was to be the last and most beloved of all, Rasul of Allah, Nabi of Allah? O mountains of Mecca, you were there when the prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair. Engraved in his heart were the words of his Lord to all of mankind. This was his call: La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. O people, praise only Allah, glorify
I'm Kabatav Waid. In today's program, we have the honor and pleasure of having with us Dr. Manoucher Motaki. If you're not familiar with Dr. Motaki, he was the former foreign minister of Iran during the time that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was in office. Now, he's very familiar with Iranian politics. He's been a fixture in it for quite some time. And one of the aspects that he's very familiar with is Iran's nuclear file, not only during the time when he was in office, but also given the recent developments that have happened in that file, of which we will discuss with him at length in this edition of the program. Dr. Motsaki, welcome to Unscripted.
Pleasure being with you.
Thank you. Let's start off with, I don't know if you want to call it a celebration, but it's an end of a decade of what's called, what was called the JCPOA. Give us your thoughts as to what you think it represented, and now that it's over, where you see this file going, and what positives and negatives were entailed during the time it was in existence.
The JCPOA is yet another case initiated from the goodwill of Iranian officials. Negotiations lasted for 2 years, and now 10 years have passed since the agreement was reached. According to UN Security Council Resolution 2231, sanctions against Iran were supposed to be suspended after these 10 years. However, in practice, they not only have remained in place, but the United States' extraterritorial sanctions have even imposed harsher restrictions on Iran than those that existed before the deal. Iran's optimistic approach was short-lived, as it was met with a disproportionate response from the other parties. Despite Iran's full compliance with its obligations, the other sides, particularly the United States and the European Troika, refused to uphold theirs. The U.S. withdrew from the deal midway, and the European parties not only neglected their commitments to lift sanctions, but even went further by imposing new ones. For us, the JCPOA's most important promise was the lifting of sanctions after 10 years. While we do not celebrate this milestone, we honor the perseverance and resilience of the Iranian people in withstanding a decade of unjust sanctions. Last month marked the end of the JCPOA's 10-year term. I believe that the unlawful and unfair decision by the three European countries to trigger the snapback mechanism, this time turned against them. For the first time in the history of the UN Security Council, a division emerged among its permanent members, those who, despite occasional differences, had generally maintained a unified stance on Iran's nuclear program. We saw China and Russia, together with Iran, condemning the European Troika's action as illegal and illegitimate. They formally expressed their objections in letters to the UN Secretary General and the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The Russian representative, who held the Security Council presidency at the time, articulated this position explicitly. So, from our perspective, the JCPOA has effectively come to an end. Now, what I propose is that, beyond our officials' acknowledgement of the deal's expiry, we should formally announce our withdrawal from it, as the agreement has brought us no tangible benefits. As we say in Persian, it is time to pull out this bad tooth that has brought us nothing but pain and loss. Such a step would also prevent the Europeans from exploiting the JCPOA as a means to exert further pressure on us. Therefore, I believe Iran should officially withdraw from the JCPOA, and after that, our peaceful nuclear activities, like those of any other normal country, will continue solely in accordance with safeguard obligations and under IAEA supervision.
Well, we have the Iranian Foreign Minister, Abbas Araghchi, who, in an interview very recently, again state that Iran will not negotiate its missile program. He said no sane person would accept its disarmament. He also said we cannot stop uranium enrichment, and also adding what cannot be gained through war cannot be gained through politics. When he says that, and when you state that we should enter a new framework of negotiations, how will this particular two non-negotiables be negotiated?
The Americans not only failed in the JCPOA, but also in their overall approach to negotiations.
During Trump's first term, Washington called for talks with Iran while simultaneously imposing maximum pressure and harsh sanctions, a request that Iran firmly rejected. Even Trump's letter to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, delivered by the Japanese Prime Minister, was dismissed. Our leader made it clear that while he respects the Japanese Prime Minister as a friend, he does not accept Trump's message. In his second term, Trump again called for negotiations, but we had no reason to trust him, given America's record of broken promises. The United States has repeatedly tried to deceive its counterparts in negotiations. A lesson Iran has learned over the past 46 years, from the 1981 Algiers Accords to this day. We agreed to indirect talks with the U.S., but they turned out to be nothing but a cover for Israel's preparations to attack Iran. The U.S. itself admitted that it was aware of Israel's planned aggression. These negotiations were therefore a deception. Why should we negotiate with those whose only goal is to mislead us, especially when they push the talks into a dead end before they even begin? They claim to seek dialogue only to deny Iran its right to enrich uranium, a demand that is unlawful, illegitimate, and contrary to international law. As a member of the international community and a signatory to the NPT, Iran has the inherent right to enrichment. Who are they to tell us otherwise? No one has the authority to dictate that Iran cannot exercise this right. They have also claimed that Iran should be deprived of defensive capabilities. Today, any person, even a child, only by looking at what has occurred between Iran and Israel over the past 6 months, can tell that disarming Iran would simply give Israel a free hand to carry out more attacks. Would the United States ever agree to negotiate over its own defense capabilities? Iran holds a vital geopolitical and geostrategic position. This region is the heart of the world, the center of global energy and economy. In such a sensitive environment, should a country like Iran not be able to defend itself? Naturally, the United States has no right to interfere in this matter. So when the U.S. raises issues such as Iran's enrichment and missile programs, its true objective is to sabotage the negotiations. The leader of the Islamic Revolution emphasized the same point in his speech last month. Therefore, Iran will not engage in talks with the United States unless Washington first recognizes Iran's right to enrichment and self-defense. Only after such acknowledgement would Iran consider discussing other matters.
So if you were to take a comparative analysis during the time that you were foreign minister, in which you had a voice for the negotiations, given what we're looking at now, do you see there being any type of breakthrough?
Let me share my personal point of view. As a member of parliament, I see no necessity at this time to negotiate with the United States. There is nothing left that requires such negotiations. We believe that the Americans have no right to interfere in our internal affairs. Therefore, I see little chance that there will be any negotiations with the United States in the foreseeable future.
Let's go back to the question I want to ask is about Russia's role and even China's role in terms of Iran when it comes to its nuclear file, and now that we have experienced the 12-day aggression from the Israeli regime against Iran, the 12-day war, as some call it, we are seeing a much more active support, at least it appears that way, from Russia, also from China. Do you think that they are doing what they can to support Iran as much as is possible? Or do you see any restraints there? Do you see any impediment or any restrictions on their side to assist Iran, or can they do more?
Russia and China fully understand Iran's strategic significance. 40 years ago, when I headed the East Asia Department at the Foreign Ministry, the Chinese Foreign Minister, Mr. Wu Jian, paid a visit to Iran. It was the first such visit by a Chinese foreign minister. After his meeting with Iranian officials, as he prepared to depart, he told us that a strong Iran is in China's interest. Today, Russia wholeheartedly shares the same perspective, that an independent and powerful Iran serves the interests of its friends, both regionally and globally. Our relations with China and Russia have had ups and downs, but today they rest on mutual understanding, shared interests, and a common perception of current realities. These are strong foundations for a strategic partnership. Russia once avoided describing its ties with Iran as strategic, but now it announces it openly. China, likewise, considers Iran a strategic partner. While other energy suppliers to China may face disruptions under external pressure, Beijing understands that its energy cooperation with Iran will remain in place and benefit both nations. So we regard China and Russia as our natural and reliable partners. Regarding Iran's nuclear program, we have previously raised our concerns with both countries. During my time as foreign minister, I addressed this directly with Mr. Sergei Lavrov in a two-hour discussion. I explained that although Russia and China may refrain from proposing new resolutions against Iran at the UN Security Council, and often seek to moderate Western proposed drafts, our objection lies in the fact that they still vote in favor of those drafts. We had a very candid and constructive exchange on this matter with both the Russians and the Chinese. During one of my visits to China, I asked the foreign minister under what circumstances China would exercise its veto power at the Security Council. My point was that if China does not share the Western position on Iran's nuclear program, it should veto their proposed resolutions. Today, China and Russia have adopted such a stance. For the first time, and due to several factors, including their relations with Iran and the increasing hostility of the West and the United States, they have decided to bring more of their capacities into action. For example, they have stated that certain issues should now be handled within the Security Council framework, making it more difficult for Western states to pass resolutions unilaterally. Furthermore, under Resolution 2231, the Iran case has been completely removed from the Security Council's agenda, and the JCPOA has effectively come to an end. I therefore view China and Russia as playing a positive and constructive role, both in their relations with Iran and in broader international affairs. China is now the world's largest economy, and by 2030, it will overtake the United States and take the lead in the global economy. As for Russia, I believe that through prudent management, it will overcome its current challenges. The Ukraine issue will eventually be resolved. Even some recent U.S. statements indicate that Washington is adopting a more realistic view of the Ukraine issue, and we hope that this crisis will come to an end soon.
When it comes to Iran's relationship with not only China and Russia that we've been discussing, there's a certain impact